Good morning. It's 8:06 on KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. On this Thursday morning, it's about 50 degrees, depending on where you are in the Wasatch back right now, and it will be getting warmer this week. Some summer-like conditions. With more on the forecast, we have ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Thursday. Mostly sunny skies expected for today. A little breezy, but also a little on the mild side. We're going to be seeing those temperatures in the upper 70s to near 80 in Park City. We'll have those high temperatures in the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. But as we go into your Friday, the heat returns across northern Utah. That means temperatures jumping into the low to mid-80s for us in Park City with mostly sunny skies. We'll see those highs climbing to around 90 degrees again in the Heber Valley. Again, mostly sunny skies expected, breezy conditions. That means an elevated fire danger threat. I think that elevated fire danger threat turns to a critical fire danger threat as we go into our Saturday with lots of sunshine, but the winds are really going to pick up. We're likely looking at some pretty gusty southwesterly winds as we go throughout your Saturday, and that'll make sure that temperatures stay on the warm side into the mid-80s in Park City with highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. But again, that wind will lead to a critical fire danger threat. So be careful doing any recreating outside. That does include things like parking the vehicle on grassy surfaces. And of course, obviously, hopefully, be aware of any flammable material that you may have in and around your area. Otherwise, as we go into your Sunday, a little boundary that moves through, it won't really bring us a big chance of precipitation, a very slight chance of a pop-up shower. We're talking around 10%, so not a really high chance. Otherwise, we're going to be looking at, again, partly cloudy skies, so a few extra clouds and a little cooler with those temperatures, about 10 degrees cooler in Park City. We'll go from the mid-80s to the mid-70s for highs, and we'll go from about 94 high in the Heber Valley to highs around 80 on your Sunday for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into next week, high pressure begins to rebuild across the area. That brings back the heat for your Monday and Tuesday. Highs back into the mid to upper 70s in Park City. We'll have those highs in the low to mid 80s in the Heber Valley. But then we start to cool it back down a little bit by the middle of next week with low 70s for highs in Park City and upper 70s for highs in the Heber Valley. By next Wednesday, rain chances still looking slim to none. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And there's no traffic to report or unusual traffic to report in the Wasatch back, according to the Utah Department of Transportation's maps this morning. But if you or anyone you know is commuting up from Salt Lake today, you should let them know it is slow going on eastbound I-80 and 215 just before the mouth of Parley's Canyon. As far as eastbound 80, it does look like there is a single lane closure. The left lane is closed just as you enter Parley's due to what appears to be, as far as the cameras go, a spill in the road there just before you go under the 215 overpass. As for why 215 is bumper to bumper right now at 33rd South, I cannot see on the cameras very well. If you do see anything out there on the roads, if you can safely text 435-655-8255 and I can let your fellow motorists know. But again, we're seeing some pretty slow traffic on eastbound I-80 and 215 as you approach Parley's Canyon. But once you get into the canyon, it is smooth sailing, certainly easier than it was earlier this week with some of the accidents that we saw. Once again, I-80, 215 eastbound, slow at the mouth of Parley's Canyon. And all right, coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be speaking with Summit County Councilmember Canice Hart about yesterday's county council meeting. It included a discussion about potential regulations to short-term rentals. And then the volunteer group Camas Action will stop by to preview some upcoming summer kickoff events and volunteer opportunities in southern Summit County. Then Jack Campbell with the High Country Fly Fishing Club talks about Saturday's free fishing day event at the Deer Valley Ponds. And Summit County is a financial supporter of this radio station. And today on Cool Science Radio, Lynn Ware Peak and Scott Greenberg talk all things artificial intelligence. Their first guest will be Beth Simone Novak, professor and director of the Burns Center for Social Change at Northeastern University. In her new book, Reboot, AI and the Race to Save Democracy, Novak explores whether artificial intelligence will weaken democracy or help save it. Then Dr. Manish Parashar, the new chief AI officer for the University of Utah, will explain how his department is helping shape the future of ethical and responsible AI here in Utah and across the nation. That's on Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m. after the local news hour. Turning now to local news, Park City's March sales tax report shows just how much this season's warm winter impacted the community. KPCW's Christine Weller reports revenue was down 20% compared to 2025.
Park City Manager Adam Lenhard says March was a bad month when it comes to city sales taxes. Revenue was down $1.4 million, or about 20%, compared to 2025. The figure excludes transient room taxes from hotel stays and short-term rentals.
March is exactly when the impacts of that weak winter finally showed up in the numbers.
According to a staff report, earlier winter sales taxes showed more resilience than expected given the season's low snowpack. But by March, a lack of snow and ski resort visitors led to a decrease in spending in town. Sales tax from January to March was also down 9% compared to last year. March is one of the city's most important winter revenue months and is crucial when planning for next fiscal year's budget, which starts in July. Though March revenue was 19% below the 2025 budget, Lenhard said the city will still be able to balance the financial plan.
We have healthy reserves, and this is the exact reason why we have those reserves, to level out the occasional down year. At this point, we are looking at last winter as an anomaly, and hopefully this winter is great.
Lenhard said the city is more concerned about the impact on local businesses and employees.
That was a dramatic decrease in their revenues, and so we're very concerned about the health of our local businesses and their ability to weather these downturns.
Sales tax revenue goes into Park City's general fund, which pays for employees and fundamental services, including police, street maintenance, open space management, and the library. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The Park City Sunday Market returns to Old Town this weekend, June 7th, with local artists, chefs, farmers, and music. The free market will run 11 Sundays this summer from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Lower Main Street. Park City Executive Director Kate McChesney encourages visitors to walk, bus, or bike to the market. She says about 200 vendors will be there each week.
Live music starting at noon, but we'll have quiet music from 10 till 12. The bar opens at 10 with our world-famous Bloody Marys and all these wonderful frozen cocktails. The vendors are popping. We've got some flowers coming in this week. We've got a lot of youth vendors and a lot of youth musicians that'll be playing music all up and down Main Street till 5 o'clock.
Park City also offers a free bike valet run by the Park City High School mountain bike team. The event began in 2006 as a flea market. The organization will celebrate 20 years in 2027 because the COVID-19 pandemic paused operations in 2020. The Park City Sunday Market is 4 Sundays in June, 2 weekends in July, the last weekend of August, and 4 Sundays in September. Wasatch County prosecutors and a local teacher have reached a plea deal after she was charged with hitting a disabled student. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the agreement closes the case.
Wasatch County School District teacher Angela Rose George was charged with one felony count of abuse or neglect of a child with a disability in April 2024. The 4th District Court case was resolved May 27th through a no-contest plea agreement that reduced the felony to a Class A misdemeanor. By pleading no contest, George accepted punishment from the court without admitting any guilt or going to trial. As part of the deal, the court agreed to hold the plea in abeyance for 1 year, provided that George complete skills courses, including one in anger management. George finished the classes prior to the hearing, so the court also agreed to a nunc pro tunc, or now for then, agreement, which closed the case. At the hearing, the alleged victim's mother said her young child has continued to deal with the emotional effects of the alleged harm. George said she hoped the hearing would bring closure to all involved. The Wasatch County School District placed George on paid administrative leave in April 2024. It is now up to the State Board of Education whether to make any changes to George's teaching license. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
On the phone now, Summit County Council Member Candace Hart. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks, Connor. Good morning.
Good morning. So council met yesterday, and the longest discussion was certainly focused on short-term rentals. The council or county and county staff have been entertaining potential regulations for a few years now. There was a subcommittee meeting on this, and as far as I could tell from yesterday's discussion, it looks like the potential regulations could be prohibitions in certain neighborhoods. Do I have that right?
Well, that's what I heard. I also heard that there needs to be quite a bit of conversation about that idea. I mean, is, you know, where is the council philosophically? Do they agree with this or not? And certainly the reasons given to potentially restrict neighborhoods were subjective, which they're allowed to do, you know, make subjective decisions and suggestions in this case. But I think that's what we'll have to weigh in on and consider. And we need to get a public process, too, where the public could give us feedback and let us know what they think.
Yeah, so you're not on the subcommittee, if I'm correct. That's council members Hansen and Armstrong. So I don't expect you to know all of the behind the scenes as far as these discussions have gone so far. But it seems like some of the rationale that has been given for these regulations is looking at neighborhoods where there might be a health and safety risk, especially as it relates to emergency and wildfire evacuation. I've always heard the council discuss nightly rentals in terms of development and land use and housing issues. This was a first for me. Did it surprise you as well?
No, obviously, as the chair, you know, I keep in touch with all our subcommittees and with the people on our subcommittee. So I'd already been briefed before we even had the meeting, as well as speaking with our clerk, who's part of this process. So not surprised, but it's also interesting because I think it's right to be looking at safety as a reason to do or not do something. It's certainly one of the responsibilities of the council. And I do think that some of the initial motivations were around the idea of trying to free up the rental market for long-term rentals. But not surprised that they're focused on safety. What we have to be careful of, in particular around fires, right now, Park City, my understanding is the fire district chiefs are not signing a letter or giving this direction that they think these areas are unsafe or that they cannot service these areas. I believe our clerk referenced a state map that has just been released. But what we have to really be careful of is a body who, well-intentioned, declares something not safe based on fire. If that's the case, there isn't a repercussion. Like now the insurance companies look and say, hey, look, the government body here declared your area unsafe and now we can't give you homeowners insurance or something to that effect. So they have to find that balance of safety, certainly, making sure that we pick areas that, you know, we can argue and defend why we think something is or isn't safe. Like one of the arguments I heard was road access, like very limited road access, confusing for people that are in from out of town. You know, we'll need to explore those arguments further, but that seems to be the direction they're going. And honestly, I think it's appropriate that that's the way they're looking at it. The devil's in the details, though, and we're going to have to really get into which neighborhoods and why they declare a neighborhood safe or not safe for nightly rentals.
And I'm going to wait to list all the neighborhoods until I can sit down and look at the meeting transcript and do that on the website later today. But just so people know, the tentative neighborhoods that were listed yesterday are not things like Kimball Junction. It's more, you know, your Summit Parks and your upper Weber Canyons above Oakley, these more remote, steeper slopes, more involved with, I guess, an Airbnb guest being able to safely escape those areas. You know, how much of this is nuisance related as well, though? What have you heard from constituents who have asked you or asked council members to look at regulations for nightly rentals?
I'm not sure that, say, from the subcommittee, how much of it's nuisance or not, but I can confirm we have heard plenty of feedback from the neighbors in Summit Park, as an example. There's quite a few neighbors that are not happy with the nightly rentals that are taking place around them. Largely, when you have nightly rentals, sometimes you get larger groups. They have parking issues. We see increased trash use, more violation of noise ordinances as they're having parties or get-togethers. And Summit Park has been very active in voicing their concern, and that's been heard loud and clear. I did not hear that myself from the subcommittee, though it could be something they're thinking about. I thought, you know, you recap some of the neighborhoods really correctly, like in the Kimball Junction area, let's say, or the Snyderville Basin. Summit Park was one of the neighborhoods they mentioned, but they did not mention Jeremy Ranch or Pinebrook. Now, in some cases, the HOAs already take care of this, but that was an example. I think you mentioned Weaver Canyon, which I heard as well. I also heard Samick, for people that aren't familiar with that, when you're leaving Camas, going up Highway 150 into the Uintas, there's a little town that you hit called Samick, which is Camas spelled backwards. So it was interesting that they had actually, I thought, a fairly restrained list. I thought they were going to go much broader than what we heard, but that's also part of what the conversations will be going forward. So, like, in fairness to the subcommittee and all the council members, there's a lot of dialogue still to be had.
Yeah, and some of that at a public hearing, it sounds like. So what opportunities for public comment do you anticipate, and when?
Well, I'm not sure the date of it, but they talk towards the end of summer, so we seem to be targeting around there. But this is also something that's been in the works for 2-3 years now. So, you know, we're giving it good due diligence, but I think right now it would be in everyone's best interest to get it in the public space as soon as possible. You know, whatever's reasonable, like, we got to give them time to refine things and get their presentations ready. But we don't want them to get so far into it that it feels fully baked. And then, you know, you take public comment and then there isn't really time to flex or adjust as needed. So it's striking that balance. And what I heard was towards the end of the summer, which, it's funny, we're already in June, so it's really not that far away.
Yeah, I find myself listening to the discussions on short-term rentals, thinking about the various extremes council could go with, and one of those, I guess, being doing nothing, maybe. The other, you know, can you talk about why not just ban them altogether? What are the concerns there?
Well, I think one of the kind of easy examples would be that, you know, nightly rentals do fill an important rental market, you know, a need, right? I mean, most of us now all travel, and when you go someplace, sometimes you want to stay in a hotel, depending on where you're going. But other times, like if I travel with my, well, you know, my wife, as everybody knows, Katie, if anyone knows my wife, Katie Wang, she runs Park City Film, and we go out to the Telluride Film Festival. And when we go out as a family, we like to get a short-term rental in town. Because then we can all stay together as a family in a house, and then we can walk around to various movies. Well, in our world, let's say someone's going skiing at the canyons, a short-term rental may make really good sense for them, like in that resort area. And that's just one example, but like there are some places where a short-term rental market, not only is it effective and wanted, but in some cases it's actually written into the development agreements, like in the canyons as an example. So I think we just have to, I don't think one would want to make a blanket policy that said all yes or all no. I think whatever ends up happening, you're going to have to be selective. There will be some areas that really make good sense for these. It's also, for a lot of people, it might be the way they get to buy their home. Maybe they can't afford it on their own, but they can use it as nightly rentals, or they can supplement their income with it to be able to afford the house. That's not necessarily the thing we'll look at. We'll look at neighborhoods that are appropriate, but it's not that it's something you'd want to just get rid of altogether.
Gotcha. And, you know, the properly licensed ones are a source of transient room tax revenue, right?
They are, thanks for bringing up the properly licensed, because I would say that, you know, that was a good chunk of that meeting last night, is, you know, from being there, but it's really one of the largest issues is just literally safety and well-being, right? And that's why you heard that subcommittee talking about neighborhoods and about safety issues. What we really need and require is all nightly rental operators to have a business license. And that's what we don't have right now. We don't have full compliance. And we have a compliance officer who's a former police chief who's leading this effort. So I have nothing but confidence in his ability to manage this, as you heard in great detail, like so the approach they're taking. But right now it's about trying to first get everybody into compliance, get their business license. We need to look at fire safety. You know, now that you're doing a a rental? Like, do you have the appropriate safety measures? We need to look at things like I mentioned before, it might be impact fees around increased trash use. That's additional trash going into our landfills. They may need multiple cans. There are things like that that you absolutely need to have the person licensed properly, inspected properly, and to make sure they're safe.
Yeah, that was, I'm seizing on the potential legislation, but most of this was talking data since before it sounded, you weren't able to map out where these short-term rentals are. With this new software the county has, this new staff member dedicated to short-term rental code enforcement, you've got data for the first time as you go through the regulatory process. Were you surprised at all of where you saw some of those short-term rentals pop up in the county?
I don't think I was surprised. I'm not to say that not somebody might be, but I think they mostly pop up in the areas you think they're going to be. There were a few where I was like, oh, that's interesting. I wouldn't have expected, you know, Weaver Canyon, as an example, has as many rentals as it does. It's a beautiful area, though. So, I mean, I could see why somebody might want to go stay there. I really love being up in Weaver Canyon. So I don't know that I would say use the word I was surprised. But what I was mostly was really pleased to see the data, and that we have the data, and that we're tracking it, and we know who the offenders are, and that there's a really good process. It's probably one of the best compliance processes I've seen the county have, you know, and I was just really happy about that portion of it.
All right. Before we're out of time here, I want to turn quickly to your role at the sheriff's office, where you're the search and rescue operations manager. But I've been meaning to ask because I've seen you pop up as on more probable cause statements as I do my daily court checks as the, you know, the deputy booking certain people into jail. Are you, you know, taking on an expanded role at the sheriff's office?
It has evolved, that's for sure. I originally was hired as a civilian, which is, when you think about it, I've been around search and rescue for a while and certainly had been a part of the Friends of Summit County Search and Rescue. But about a year ago, I took the role as the operations manager. I'm replacing, it's like a one-for-one swap in jobs. I'm replacing the outgoing person who's been in charge, Lieutenant Sidaway, who has not retired yet. And, you know, selfishly, I hope he stays forever, but at some point he's planning on doing it. So the idea was to get me in and trained up under him so that when he does retire, you know, we don't miss a beat over there. But I ended up going to post and becoming a certified deputy. And the last portion of that training, which is what I was just completing, is field training officer. So at night when everybody's going to sleep, I'm headed out on patrol. And once I get finished with that, I go right back to search and rescue. But the difference is now I am a sworn law enforcement officer. So I am a deputy who is the operations manager for search and rescue.
Yeah. And I want to, you know, I think this was a question last year, but I want to raise it again before budget season this year. I mean, as a county employee, you've got a leg up on other employees in the sense that you'll get to vote on the county budget. What are you planning to do as far as that this year, recusing yourself, disclosing it again as you did last year? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I wish I had a leg up. I mean, it's one of those things that it sounds cool, but no, the reality is you don't really have any advantage. The way the budget process works for the county is departments across the county and all divisions, they submit their budgets within their departments. It goes to a budget committee, which I'm not part of, and the budget committee is the one who refines everything, and they end up proposing to the county manager a budget. Then the county manager looks at that budget, and the county manager says, okay, I like this budget. They send it to the council. And then anything related to the sheriff's office, I just recuse myself. I just step out of the room, literally physically walk out of the room. They finish discussing whatever needs to happen, and then I just come back in and weigh in. And then generally speaking, certainly my role in the council, one of the things I'm really proud about is I have not voted to raise property taxes in the entire time I've been on council. In fact, I haven't voted to raise property or sales taxes while on council. And the thing that I look for in the budget mostly is I say, all right, when the county manager presents their budget to the council, the first question is just simply, are you asking for a tax increase or not? And if they want a tax increase, and what we've done every year and I will continue to do is say, okay, if you're saying you need a tax increase, I want you to go back and work the budget so you don't need a tax increase. And I'm really proud to say that I've consistently done that. And that's really where the council's role is at. We come in at a very high level. Like, are you on budget? Are you off budget? What are the big macro things? Council doesn't actually weigh in on, like, line item stuff. That would not be a good use of anyone's time. It's really a whole budget committee. So, yeah, so if there's something that even hints at being questionable, I just recuse myself and come back to it later. But really, my main focus is to make sure that we do not have any property tax increases, at least not from the county side. I know other areas and other lines on your property tax statements, that's where you're getting the increases. It's not from the council.
Okay. And quickly, before we go, your thoughts on this coming summer from a SAR perspective. Can you kind of take us behind the scenes of what you're planning as far as agency and how your staffing is for what is expected to be hotter, drier, and longer than normal?
Yeah, and, you know, if nothing else, the trends show is that it just gets busier every year in search and rescue. And search and rescue across the country, especially in the American West, has really evolved to, like, very busy, very active organizations. It's like when you had volunteer fire departments running things, what you're seeing now and more are search and rescue teams becoming professionalized so they can keep up with the training just to, like, cover the costs that these volunteers are pouring themselves into. And an example of that is last July, and I think in August typically, we run anywhere around 20 to 25 SAR missions a month. So sometimes it sounds like, you know, that's like almost one every day, but sometimes you may get a day off, but you have two on one day or three on a day. So like this Tuesday coming up, the SAR team, which I won't be a part of, but the search and rescue team will be up in the Uintas training with DPS, the Department of Public Safety helicopters. And they're preparing for extractions. And for people that aren't too familiar with search and rescue, there's that traditional thing you think of like a lost hiker. But a large part of what search and rescue does is they're like EMS for the mountains. They're either taking EMS personnel to a patient or getting a patient to EMS. And that's why there's so many calls in the volume as people are getting hurt while they're out and about. And keep in mind, we have 1,800 square miles in our county. So we're as big as the state of Delaware. So this team of about 42 volunteers covers the state of Delaware as far as extractions and emergency rescues that take place in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Summit County Council Member Candace Hart, we've been speaking with. Thank you, Candace. Over 100 locals attended Park City's annual Spring Projects Open House Tuesday. KPCW's Christine Weller reports residents opposed to Bonanza Park site plans made a vocal showing.
Locals packed the Park City Library patio Tuesday for Park City Municipal's annual Spring Projects Open House. It was an opportunity to learn about a range of projects, from Park City Mark Pool upgrades to the golf course master plan, bus stop improvements, and more. But many were there to push back on preliminary Bonanza Park site plans, which the Park City Council approved in March. One discussion between Councilmember Molly Miller and a resident got so heated that police were called. Miller confirmed to KPCW that she was at a table sharing information about the Bonanza Park plans when an attendee came up behind her. After asking a few questions, Miller said the resident expressed displeasure with the plan and, quote, forcefully smacked her on the arm. When Miller asked the person to please not touch her, they responded, quote, I don't even want to look at you.
I did speak to Park City Police Department about a physical confrontation, and they have referred the case, such as it is, to another agency.
Miller did not identify the person and said she doesn't plan to press charges. She said she encourages others to, quote, turn down the temperature and treat each other with dignity and respect. Longtime resident Andrea Barros was one of more than a dozen attendees from Place PC, a loosely organized resident group opposed to the plans.
We're here today because we're proponents for keeping the 5 acres green. If they pave that over and they put 3 and 4 story apartment buildings in it, we will have lost that opportunity forever.
Each Place PC member wore green to advocate for green space on the 5 acre site instead of the planned mixed use development, which includes 106 residential units, 1.2 acres of open space, and underground parking. Steve Patisse is also part of the group, sharing their vehement criticism of the project's direction with city staff and the developer.
To put all this development in there will just congest this city beyond belief.
Despite the group's complaints, the open house wasn't an opportunity to shift the trajectory of the project. The council's last public hearing on the 5 acres was in March before it advanced the plans. Locals will have a chance to weigh in when the Park City Planning Commission considers the proposal sometime this summer. it's unlikely the plans would change significantly. Those decisions rest with the council. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Here in the studio now is Kate Wynn. She's the secretary at the volunteer group Camas Action. Kate, thank you so much for coming in.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, so you've got some events planned in southern Summit County to kind of kick off summer, beginning with some Main Street cleanup, beautification, yep. flower-related activities. Yes. What's happening this week?
So for the last, I think, 6 years, we've been putting planter barrels on Main Street. And this Saturday is the day when we fill them. So 10 a.m. at Camas City Hall, come and get some plants and put them in the barrels and make Main Street look beautiful.
Should I bring my own gloves,
yes,
tools?
Definitely.
What will be provided?
Bring your own gloves. Everything else is provided.
Okay. And, you know, for folks who don't know Camas Action, can you kind of explain where the group came from and who's a part of it?
Sure. It started with... Camas City brought in a team, and I always get this wrong, it's RUDAT, which I think is, I wrote it down, Regional Urban Design Assistance Team, who came and wandered around the town for a while and then gave pointers as to things that could be done to make the town better, I guess, and Camas Action came out of that. Been going since 2020. The planter barrels were the first thing we did. We also do Gateway to Summer, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And then we run another event in December called Winterfest, which is a tree lighting and carols and all those, you know, fun local traditional things that everybody likes. So, and that's about it. There's four of us on the volunteer team, plus another two who help with the market. The market's been going for, I think, 3 years now, and that's virtually every month on the second Saturday of the month at the event centre
in
Camas.
501c3 application pending.
Yes, it's been pending for a while. It takes a while. It's got to go through the IRS, so it's, yeah.
They're going to move at the speed of the federal government.
Exactly, yes.
So, yeah, tell me more about the Gateway to Summer event that's happening the 12th and 13th.
Yes. It's 2 days this year, which is new. For the last 5 years, it's been just the Saturday. It started when Camas Valley History Group launched their museum, and Camas Action ran a festival, basically, to celebrate that. And also, we were raising awareness to build the Veterans Memorial, which we teamed with the American Legion Auxiliary, and we finally got phase one in last year, so that's very exciting. And then when Camas City opened the event centre, we've moved there. It's live music, there'll be a market, we've got food trucks, we've got kids' activities, bounce houses. And this year, it's 2 days because we are running an arts contest, which will be starting on the Friday, and people can come and vote. So we have a food truck, and we're very excited. We've got Shrink the Giant performing on Friday, and then two other really cool musicians on Saturday, Aubrey Rose and Kate Chanson, and a couple of food trucks. So it's going to be great.
You're on just in time to mention the arts contest, because the deadline to apply to participate as an artist is tomorrow?
We've actually moved it to Monday.
Okay.
So, yeah, you've still got time.
what are you looking for there? What kind of art will you accept?
It's all kinds of arts and crafts. So far that I'm aware of, we've got some food, we've got some sculpture, I think we have jewelry, we've got paintings. The wonderful, wonderful middle school teacher, Camille Vernon, is bringing some of her school kids' work. So it's everything from, you know, 9-year-olds through to adults. And we're breaking it into two categories, so it's under 18 and over 18. And then there'll be a prize for each category, depending on what we get. But we're after everything. We want the Valley to show how creative it can be.
The categories are People's Choice, Judge's Choice, and Best in Show.
Yes.
So what kind of spoils come with those winning those?
there are rosettes, and there will be fabulous cash prizes, which I am not going to tell you how much they are because we haven't decided yet.
Okay. All right. Maybe 4 digits, or are we talking 3 digits? 2 digits?
Probably 2 digits.
Okay. Gotcha. So what else? Any exciting food that you're hoping to highlight next weekend?
We've got... I can't say it in Spanish. We have a taco truck, an absolutely amazing taco truck. My friend, who is the food truck expert, tells me they're the best tacos she's ever had. That's on Friday. And then on Saturday, we've got Shaka Shake Bowl, which is Korean Hawaiian fusion, and it's awesome. And then one of our vendors is doing candied nuts and snow cones, so that'll be great too.
All right, so this is the Gateway to Summer annual event by Camas Action. The location, again, is the new event center, well, relatively new now, 4th South on Main Street in Camas. What else are you organizing over the course of the summer? Anything else that you want to highlight at this early stage?
For the summer, there'll be another market in August. We're not doing anything in July because it's just too busy. Camas Action will be running a chalk art contest at Fiesta Days. Other than that, we're taking a bit of a rest.
July is busy, busy on the east side.
Yes, it is, definitely.
All right, so we've been speaking with Kate Wynn from Camas Action. Kate, was there anything else you want to mention?
That's it. Just come and help us plant planters on Saturday, please.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
In studio now with Jack Campbell. Jack, you're with the local chapter of Trout Unlimited, but I'm unaware of your title.
I am a past president and a member in good standing, I hope.
Of the High Country Fly Fishers, and you're organizing a free Learn to Fly Fish event at the Deer Valley Ponds on Saturday.
Yes. The state of Utah every year has one day when anybody in the state can fish without a fishing license. And that's usually the first Saturday of June, and it is this year, June 6th, coming up.
All right. So it's from 10 to 2 on Saturday, centered around the gazebo at the Deer Valley Ponds for folks that know that area. What will you have there? Yeah, and for people that want to learn to fly fish, how can they participate?
Well, the club is providing pretty much everything. We have fishing rods and volunteers to help people, and this is something that neophytes, beginners can participate in, or if you've got a little bit of experience, you come down and maybe just fish with us too. So you can bring your own fly rod if you want, or come down and we'll supply everything. All we would recommend is some eye protection, maybe sunglasses or something like that.
Sunscreen maybe too.
Hopefully it's sunny.
Yes. How many members do you have in the local chapter? How many will be participating and instructing?
Well, there are different lists according to that. Trout Unlimited allows you to belong to any chapter in the country, and so we have several hundred members on our membership list. Active, we probably have between 50 members, plus or minus a little bit. We'll have a dozen or more people helping out on Saturday.
Okay, and I'm seeing free hot dogs. Is that bait or is it human food?
No, it's all fly fishing, so it's all flies, We do want to entertain people, so free hot dogs, sodas, water will be available.
I'm not a very skilled fisher. I'm rod and reel, $40 from Walmart type fishing. So, you know, how is fly fishing different than, you know, what people might think of with just a guy in a boat with sitting there with bait?
Well, there are different types of fly fishing, and your $40 reel fly fishing outfit from Walmart is just fine to start with. You don't have to really get into it at a high level, as people sometimes think. But we fish from the shore, which we will do at Deer Valley this weekend, where we'll cast out into the lake. And you can also fish from a boat, like standard fly fishermen or regular fishermen do in the lake. So there are different ways to do that. Also in the rivers, very popular, like in the movie A River Runs Through It, that attracts a lot of people to the sport.
Sure. I'm curious about what is different about this season because of the snowpack that we didn't get this winter, and we've seen some headlines recommending fishermen get out now, while it's good because it might not be as good later in the summer. What are you seeing? What are you doing differently in your fishing year this year?
Yeah, that's a great question. Right now we're monitoring. We're watching it very closely. I can say that it's a mixed bag, because if you're fishing in, say, a river below a reservoir, what we call a tailwater, there should be plenty of water in the reservoir to continue to move water down the river. Most of the rivers around here are used for irrigation supply, so there is a requirement to move water down the river, and that's good for the fishermen. The reservoirs are still, while they're lower than normal, they're still okay for fly fishing in most cases, or regular fishing. We'll watch that, and if a second year would be really tough on us. But I think it's going to be okay. Later in the year, the rivers that don't come out of a reservoir, what we call tailwater, such as the Upper Provo, those are going to be really tough and low water. And that's where we would not probably concentrate our fishing.
And then warmer temperatures as well? How does that affect fish?
Yeah, well, trout love water temperature below 60 degrees, and rainbow trout maybe even 55 degrees is really ideal. So it will be warmer water, and some other states, Montana in particular, have instituted programs where they don't fish in the afternoon. They're actually by law prohibited from fishing. But Utah hasn't gone there, so we would recommend that you just go out early, quit early, and enjoy the afternoon doing something else.
Gotcha. Because does the warmer water push fish upstream, downstream? Does it kind of depend where the dam is?
It does. You'll find, like, the water coming out of the dam will be in the high 40s or low 50s, and that's a good temperature. But as you get down, using the Middle Provo as an example, it comes out of Jordanelle at that temperature, and by the time it gets down to Deer Creek Reservoir, it's almost 70 degrees. So I wouldn't recommend fishing down towards Deer Creek in the afternoon as that temperature warms up, the temperature of the water warms up. I would stay close to the dam, and you'll see a lot of people concentrating on that.
That's interesting. So, like, the reservoirs are cooling the water mm-hmm. as they, because, you know, they're not as close to the surface. Less of the water is up top.
Yes, they have the ability to take water from different levels in the reservoir, and so they pretty much try to keep it at a temperature that's good for the fish, as well as keeping the river in good shape.
All right. What else is the High Country Fly Fish Club doing this summer?
Well, we have a whole list of things to do. We have kind of a three-prong approach where we do conservation, education, and then community volunteerism, too. This summer, one of our big projects is to help rehabilitate the soapstone fire up in the Uintas. And in August, combining with DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, and a number of other agencies, we're going to have a multi-day project up there where we're trying to rehabilitate a mile of stream up there, in addition to the land side around the stream, and that's to help erosion and to keep it in good shape. That'll be in August, and we're really looking for volunteers for that. But we also do other things such as education with local organizations, the Boy Scouts. We have a project with the MARC where we're teaching kids to fly fish. We have inside the club, we have beginning fly fishing lessons. We also support local universities like the Utah State University, where we supply scholarship money for people that are interested in the fly fishery programs, and doing research in that. We also support organizations like Summit Land Conservancy, which is working on conserving land, and so we think that's a win-win.
All right, and just recapping what's coming up this weekend, it's a Utah Free Fishing Day, so you can get out there even if you don't have a license. And 10 to 2 at the Deer Valley Ponds, you'll have reels and rods and people to teach you to fly fish there.
All that. We will have all the equipment you need. Just come on out. Even if you're someone that just wants to fish, we've got spots for that too. I'd suggest parking in the lower Deer Valley parking lot and looking for the gazebo and just meeting us at the gazebo.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Jack Campbell. He's a member of the local chapter of Trout Unlimited. Thanks for coming on.
Well, we're going to have a fun day. Thanks for having us.
You bet. The Park City Council will consider increasing water rates at its Thursday meeting and may approve a special event permit for mountain biking at Deer Valley. KPCW's Christine Weller has this.
The Park City Council will review proposed increases to water rates during its Thursday meeting. The council adopted a comprehensive set of water rate changes in 2025, which altered how water bills are calculated for single-family residential and irrigation accounts. Now the council is considering whether to increase those fees. According to a staff report, operating costs for the city's water system have increased significantly since 2020, largely due to equipment upgrades needed to meet drinking and stream water regulations. City Manager Adam Lenhard told KPCW he's recommending the council press pause on those proposed increases.
We do see a long-term need to at least keep up with inflation. However, given the adjustments that we just made less than a year ago, we've spent a lot of time looking at these rates and saying, are further adjustments needed?
Lenhard said he wants to see more long-term data after the 2025 changes, especially because Park City has some of the highest water rates in the state.
What we have now is not quite 1 year's worth of data under these new rates. We do see that our revenues have decreased.
Also Thursday, the council will consider approving a special event contract so Deer Valley can host the U.S. Open of Mountain Biking. Deputy City Manager Heather Sneddon said it's a level 4 permit, which means between 500 and 5,000 people could attend the event each day.
The expected attendance over those 4 days is about 9,000 people, but we're waiting to see how those RSVPs come in as we sort of decide whether or not we need to implement our transportation mitigation plan.
Sneddon said the city is excited for the event as it helps put the area on the map as a mountain bike destination. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Summit County's Mirror Lake Highway was named the most beautiful road in America by Formula 4's Felber Motorsport. Travel and Leisure magazine reports when considering search results, the 42-mile stretch had the highest mention of the keyword beautiful compared to other routes in its study. The seasonal road, which begins just outside Camas and ends in near Evanston, Wyoming, offers hiking, fishing, swimming, and mountain biking, camping, and more along the route. Colorado's 117-mile Silver Thread Scenic Byway in the San Juan Mountains came in second, followed by the 43-mile Chiricahua Skyway in Tennessee and North Carolina. The study analyzed 45 roads across the country, tapping TripAdvisor average ratings and total number of reviews from people who have visited. Summit County Stormwater Coalition is hosting its fifth annual Trails, Trash, and Tunes event, celebrating National Trails Day this Saturday, June 6th. The community cleanup and weed pull at the New Park Amphitheater near the Swanner Nature Preserve gives residents a chance to give back to the environment. Stormwater Coalition manager Kelsey Christensen says residents can also learn how removing invasive weeds helps protect local waterways.
They do coincide, and the big thing I wanted to push this year is I think we all noticed the lack of winter. So what happens if there's a lack of winter for the summer in our waterways, there's going to be a lack of water quantity. Things that people can do to help protect water quality, you can learn at our event.
The event begins at noon, and free lunch will be served to the first 50 people. The band Changing Lanes will perform. Offset will host a beer garden, and informational booths provide a chance to win prizes. Those interested are asked to RSVP for the event. That link is available at kpcw.org. Participants are asked to carpool, take public transportation, walk, or bike to the event. And after dozens of Heber residents pushed back against plans for a cell tower in their neighborhood, it'll be installed in the cemetery instead. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has this update.
Residents of Heber's Hospital Well neighborhood told city leaders they were worried about the potential health and property value impacts of installing a cell tower near their homes. Community Development Director Tony Kohler said at a city council meeting Tuesday, leaders rethought the plans after hearing those concerns.
The resounding conclusion of the neighborhood was, please don't put a cell tower here. It's really that simple.
After a planning commission meeting May 12th, the Heber City Cemetery emerged as a good location since it's farther from homes. Staff initially avoided recommending the cemetery out of respect for the dead, but locals said the city should focus more on its living residents. Here's what Commissioners Tory Broughton and Josh Knight had to say.
I think the probably biggest question of the evening was, why are we not considering the cemetery other than the dead? Was there other reasons?
I'm sure my parents won't mind.
The City Council voted to amend its contract with Atlas Communications so the company can install the tower near the cemetery's maintenance building. Atlas hopes to construct an 80-foot tower, saying the additional height would allow for more carriers and better coverage. That height exception will require the council's approval. Resident Brent Burnham thanked leaders for listening to the feedback.
When we attended the Planning Commission meeting, it was just so nice to hear people acknowledge the personal impact it would have on us in our particular situation. And I appreciate all of you taking time to really consider this.
City staff are also considering how to handle future cell tower applications. The Planning Commission has recommended creating a master plan to guide its decisions. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.